Okay, welcome to Movie Dudes, episode 211. I am Jeff, joined as always by Chris.
Hey, that's me.
And we're back from hiatus, and we have a whole bunch of movies to discuss. So let's, instead of wasting time, let's just get right into it. We're going to start with the brand new film in theaters called Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yes.
Which is an adaptation of the famous children's books, like the young adult horror books of short stories. I didn't pull up the info on it, but do you know the director?
Andre Overdahl.
Okay.
He is Swedish, I think. He directed like a Troll Hunter, which I don't know if you know what that is, but
yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
And the Autopsy of Jane Doe. They're the two that I recognize from his credits list. So.
So I didn't read a lot of reviews going into this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I read any reviews. Maybe I should have. This might have been one where might have benefited me to know a little more going in. I thought I knew all I needed to know. I knew it was based off the books. So this movie is not what I expected whatsoever. I expected, I mean, it is an adaptation of the books, and as such, I expected something like Creepshow or Tales from the Dark Side or anything like that.
You expected an anthology movie, like where
absolutely
there might be a rapper, but like they're telling these stories, which are then being acted out.
Yeah, so that's what I expected. And, you know, this movie starts off, I think, in it's like 1968. It's like Mill Creek or something, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this small town. And it kind of has like all this good atmosphere. It's got like all these kids and they're all doing stuff. And it's kind of going on for a while. And I'm like, man, this is one of the longest like anthology setups I've ever seen. Like, this is like, the wraparound story here is really long beginning, you know? I'm like 25 minutes in, I'm like, okay. Yeah. They find this book, I'm like, all right, then they're finally going to open the book and we're going to get our short stories. I'm like, this is such a long beginning. And it turns out the wraparound story is the whole fucking movie. This is essentially one haunted house movie for kids, basically. With
haunted house ghost story,
yeah, and with elements from the short stories in the books,
yes.
So kind of like some of the ghosts look like illustrations from the book, and I don't know. What did you think of it, Chris?
I didn't go in with that expectation. Although that's not a bad expect. Like I think I watched the trailers and I'm like, oh, all right, they're gonna. You know, it seems like it's going to be this group of kids that is experiencing the stories. I also don't have any like nostalgic tie to those stories.
Uh-huh.
So I was expecting a more narrative driven.
Okay.
I guess I thought that like, you know, they would pull elements, I guess, but I didn't know the stories going in. And that's kind of exactly what I got. And for a kid's horror film, I don't know if kids, like, I don't know if it's a kids horror film, but like a young adult horror film.
Yeah.
It's okay.
It is. It's hard for me to say because I was so distracted by
by that opening.
by just like, I kept like thinking about it all the time, like, why the fuck did they do it like this? Like, I just was so thrown off by that. And it is, like, you know, it's a fine little, like, ghost story for kids. And, you know, it is pretty edgy for what it is.
Yeah, I thought so. Some of the monster, you know, the way they look were pretty cool. Like, the scarecrow is decent. The weird, creepy, absorbing monsters in the red room or the red hall or something like that, that they're terrifying.
Yeah.
And then, famously from the trailer, the spider clip with the spider under, like, that's, it's terrifying. Like, it's actually like, that is a gruesome, gory kind of
oh, I yeah, mean,
it's just gross the way they handle it. But you know, it's not necessarily inappropriate for kids. It's just like, you know, they push it maybe just a little bit further than it has been before, but bring it to more modern filmmaking.
Yeah, they squeeze out everything they can out of the PG-13 rating, I think. Yeah. I like this young cast. I like the cast in general. You got Hank from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, he plays the dad. I really like the lead, Zoe Margaret Leddy, who played Stella. She was really good, and her friends, and then and her kind of, I guess, semi love interest. That they were all good. All the kids are pretty good in it.
Yeah, and there's like this douchebag guy that's kind of messing with them. And he's the one with the scarecrow in his yard, mm-hmm. or whatever. It's funny, he's from the show Euphoria, and on Euphoria he plays a total dork, like a nerdy kid on it. So it was interesting to see him
flip flopped.
Yeah, you know. But I don't know. Like it just, for me, I was so distracted by that. You know, by the end of the movie, I was just like ready for it to be done. Like, I was just like, all right, this is not what I wanted. And like, and that's another thing. It's just, it tries to do a full narrative. It's like almost 2 hours. For me, this should have been an hour and a half. It should have been a bunch of short stories. But in defense of the way they did it, I'll say this. I have not read those books since I was a little kid. And but I do remember some of the short stories being very short and thin, like a couple pages. Like that spider one probably wasn't very long, right?
Right.
So maybe this was the only way to do it where, you know, I just don't know that like some of those short stories, maybe they wouldn't translate to the screen in any sort of meaningful short. Like they might be too thin even for a short. I don't know.
Right. Cause like it's almost like they would be doing like micro movies, right? Like, cause like that, the scarecrow one is, I don't know, in this, it's maybe 5 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
The spider one, even less, like.
Which is, like, that's the length of a short film, but usually a short in a horror anthology is, like, you know, 15 minutes or something.
Right. Like, yeah, if you're thinking about, like, VHS or something more recent, like, you know, you have 15, 20 minutes for one of those shorts. And here they would have been, like, really short, more like ABCs of Death or something like that, where they're almost like microfilms.
So, like, maybe, you know, the way they did it was the only way to do it. But then, you know, my argument for that is then just don't do it. Like, what's the point? I got it. It's fine for what it is, but just for me personally, it's not what I wanted. It's I think it's a fine kind of, like, gateway movie for kids, but, like, I personally don't get a lot out of it. I don't see myself re-watching this.
No, I don't either. Like, I enjoyed my time watching it, but it's not one I'm gonna like, hey, I'm gonna rewatch this one over again. And it's weird because, and minor spoiler here, but like it wraps up like the ghost story,
yeah,
gets wrapped. But also they leave it open for a sequel. Like, how do you tie back to this book of scary stories that are coming to life?
I don't know.
But you've killed off the reason for those scary stories to come to life.
Yeah. I think this movie's doing okay.
It seems like it did pretty well.
I mean, I went on, I think, Tuesday, like at like 7 o'clock, like probably not a huge night or whatever, but showing was full, like strange.
I went on a Sunday afternoon. It was weirdly like probably more our age or a little bit younger. It wasn't like kids. Like, I mean, I didn't bring my kids to it either. They were away, but there weren't like really kids in the theater. It was like more adults, which I found a little weird. Also, and this is unrelated to the movie, but if you are going to a movie and you are going to a place where you pick your seats, do not pick a seat next to one seat unless it's packed. Like, unless the theater is completely sold out, leave a space between your seat, because this guy and his girlfriend, they bought seats directly next to me. When I bought my tickets, nobody else had bought a ticket yet.
Yeah.
I picked out the seat I wanted. These two people sat directly next to me, and then the guy like is looking at me like I chose to sit
like next to him. Picked mine first.
Right. Like I know you move. So not related to the movie, but just general etiquette. If there's a space, it's like a urinal. Don't sit next to somebody. Like,
I always, you know, always leave a space unless it, like you said, it's a full screening. You take what you can get. I don't understand people that do that. It creeps me out. Like, I sometimes will recheck after, because I pick my ticket days in advance with the AMC app, and I'll sometimes recheck to see like how the screening,
how full it is. Yeah,
and it really weirds me out when I see people like sit down next to me while there's still plenty of room left in the theater. Why did you do that?
And same thing here. Like there were other seats, but I looked while I was in the theater because I got there a little bit early because I saw a movie prior to that. So I'm sitting there in this empty. I wonder how many people are going to show up because this is a little creepy. I'm the only one in this theater right now. And I'm like, oh, it's pretty full. But when I looked, nobody was still sitting next to me. My row was empty. And then these people sat down. Like, so they consciously bought that ticket seeing that there were empty seats.
That's so weird. As for Scary Stories itself, I don't really have much else to say about it. Like, that's kind of how I felt about it.
It's fine. I wouldn't rush out to the theater to see it, but
like, it's fine. It's just don't go in thinking, like, again, it ruined it for me. Expecting one thing and getting another, but also just for me, it's just fine, but I don't care. I'm going to be a little mean on this one. I'm going to give it a 2, even though it's, like I said, it's perfectly fine for what it is, but for me personally, it was a 2. It was like a bad experience at the movies.
Yeah, that's fine. I see that. I'm gonna give it a 3. I also went in with different expectations, though. So
yeah,
it's not. It's not a memorable film, though.
It's just and I had someone say to me, "Well, like the trailer kind of spells this out," and it's like, even if the trailer did make it seem that way, I would assume that was all wraparound and that, like, you know, oh, we're still getting the short stories, because It just seems like the logical way, like a book of short stories, a logical way to adapt that to me would seem to be pick out the best stories and make the adaptations of that.
Right. And we've had, it's not like, it's, you know, it's not like Creepshow is so far in our rear view that there have been anthology films, especially in the horror genre over the last, like, you know, 5-6 years that have done well. So you would think that they would have followed that model because it makes more sense for a book of short stories that are unrelated to each other.
Yeah, but you know, I guess credit to them for trying it a different way, and you know, maybe that was the way that made more sense. But I didn't care for it. So, anyways, we're gonna start moving along because we do have, you know, we're gonna finally talk the big new Tarantino film at the end of this. I think that's gonna go on a bit. But before that, let's get to you saw some pair of other films also in theaters.
Yeah.
You saw The Lion King. Let's talk about The Lion King real quick.
All right. So I saw The Lion King, directed by Jon Favreau, who I believe also did The Jungle Book for Disney. And I'm not a huge fan of The Jungle Book, but that was an okay reimagining of that story. This is a weird one. Because where The Jungle Book, the live action adaptation of The Jungle Book, that seemed to, it transformed it in a way. It wasn't necessarily a shot-for-shot remake of the cartoon movie. It had some of the same songs, but, you know, they did something different with it when they remade it. This movie, The Lion King, is a near shot-for-shot remake of the 1994 animated film.
But just
with different
live actions, yeah.
Yeah, like I animation-wise and visually, it is a striking film. Like the animation is great. Like the animals look real. I know they're not because animals can't talk, but they look real. They look like they could be real animals. My problem is more in that it seems like all the heart and soul has been taken out of it. James Earl Jones comes back as Mufasa, the King Lion at the beginning. He's fine. He's not just fine. James Earl Jones is great. That's it. It's a great role that he did. And he delivers it again, exactly the same. But then they start hitting some weird spots where, Simba is played by Donald Glover. He does a good job as Simba. But Nala is played by Beyonce, and I thought she was bland. Mm. Not, like, just nothing there. Chiwetel Ejiofor, who I like as an actor, plays Scar, but I do not like his Scar here. Like, it doesn't work. There's no menace to him. He just, there's something missing, and maybe it's the animation. Maybe it is the live looking lions.
I was going to ask you, is it weird seeing, like, you know, in the cartoon, you can make the animals very expressive looking and cartoony. And so is it weird seeing, like, these super realistic, like, looking animals talking and shit? Like,
it is a little weird. It's a little goofy. And it's played at its best is when it's played for laughs. So when Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner as Timon and Pumbaa, or Pumbaa and Timon, so Seth Rogen plays Pumbaa, when they're on screen and they're doing their goofy shtick, and it looks goofy as shit because these, you know, this warthog and this meerkat look absurd as live action animals. It's funny, like they, and they're actually very good in this. But on the opposite side, John Oliver is Zazu, who is very expressive, like that the bird in the original Lion King is super expressive, and he's just kind of a bird here.
Yeah, you can't, like, if you're, you know, you can't have them making as many facial expressions, and
because birds would be really hard to do with facial expressions, because they can't, you know, they have a beak and shit, so it just doesn't. And I like John Oliver, I do, like, but he's terrible here. There doesn't seem to be the manic energy that Zazu has in the original, which you almost expect from John Oliver. Like, when I heard he was cast as Zazu, I was like, that's fucking, that makes a lot of sense. He's going to be great. And it was one of the lower points for me. I'm like, this is not good. So it's a weird film. The music, they use the same songs. There's just not as much emotion and heart to it. The new song that Beyonce has, like, I think it's the new song that she added, is now played in between when Simba is leaving, you know, where he was, like, living life up, and he's returning to the Pride Lands. Like, there's this montage journey of him making the trek back. And whatever that song is just awful. It's not good. It's just, I don't know. There's something missing here, and it's a shame. It's fine. I think technically, like, the film actually looks good. But I would almost like no sound. Let me just watch this nature documentary. So I don't know. I'm coming away, like, rather disappointed, much like I did with Beauty and the Beast last year. I prefer when they try something new with it. Like, I would probably rate Dumbo higher than this, just for the fact that it tried something, like, different with the story. Even if I didn't necessarily love Dumbo, at least there was something there.
Yeah, it's just, it sounds to me like most of these Disney remakes, where the big question is why. I'm always going to go back to, I might see this eventually, but if I really want to see The Lion King again, I would probably just watch the animated one. And that goes for like all of them. Like Beauty and Beast, I thought was fine when I watched it. I was in a bit of a Disney kick at the time. I think it was right around when I went to Disney World. So like I had that hype around it, but it was just, I'm never going to watch that. If I'm going to watch Beauty and Beast, I'm going to watch the animated.
Yeah, it's just, it's so much more thrilling watching it that way. I just think it works better that way.
I keep saying animated when in fact the new Lion King is basically all animated.
It's an animated film. Yeah, like it's just, it's made to look real, which I don't think adds anything to it. It's just, oh, we redid the Lion King with a new cast, but we really didn't try anything. So in a lot of ways, it's like a stage production of the Lion King.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, okay, well, I mean, I can see that too. Like that comes to town like once a year. Hey, go see the Lion. I hate that version too. So like, this is maybe a little bit better. I don't know.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to give it a 3, but it is not a strong recommend at all.
Okay. The other film that only you saw is the mega franchise Fast and the Furious as a spinoff called Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah. So one, I guess the full official title of this film is Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. That's a terrible name for a movie.
It's bloated just like this film's running time looks to be.
Yeah. This is a long movie. It's like 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yep.
And it, look, I love The Rock, Jason Statham. I love Idris Elba. I really enjoy the Fast and Furious movies because they're fucking stupid and ridiculous. This is stupid and ridiculous and excessive, but it's a bit draining. Like, it could have used a cut of maybe a half an hour, tighten this up a little bit. Had a couple more big set pieces. Because there are a couple, but like when I go to a Fast and Furious movie, especially now, I just expect like each new stunt is going to try and outdo the other one. This seems a bit toned back from that, and I don't know if that's because of the director David Leitch. He did Deadpool, but I don't think the action in that is necessarily great either. I don't know. He didn't do Deadpool. He was in Deadpool. He directed Atomic Blonde, which I think we talked about this last year or maybe the year before. I did not necessarily love Atomic Blonde either. It has a lot of style, but it's not, there's nothing really there. It's just kind of stylistically pretty. And that's like a lot of this, except there is the charisma from The Rock and Jason Statham.
Couldn't be beat up or something according to their contracts or something weird like that. Did you see that?
So I read that, but they are at points like they don't.
The thing that cracks me up is like Statham, at least my sense of him is he seems totally game for whatever, like in anything I've seen him in. So it's like, I didn't buy that, like that he would have that, that situation. And I could buy it from The Rock. The Rock seems very protective over his image and how he wants to be.
But he does get thrown around. Like, maybe he doesn't lose a fight. I guess maybe that's what I read, is that he couldn't lose any of the fights he was in. So they were either a draw, and there are definitely some fights that are just like, all right, it has ended now. Like, there was no clear winner or loser until the ending. And obviously, like, The Rock is the good guy. This ridiculous franchise, the good guys always win. So The Rock and Jason Statham win in the end here. Spoiler. they do beat Idris Elba. I don't know. I'm hoping that this doesn't spell like kind of doom for Fast and Furious going forward.
Wasn't the last one not very good from what I heard? I'm not into the series at all.
So I liked the last one, but it was beginning to
downslide
to drag a bit. Like, I think the high point is 5.
That I really
enjoy 6. 7 is a bit goofy, but also you have to tie in that, you know, Paul Walker died, I guess, right around production time in there, like during production. And then 8 is the first one after that. And 8 is like they have abandoned all reality. They are just superheroes in cars at that point. And this is The Rock and Jason Statham just being superheroes, superhero spies. Like, the cars aren't really a big deal. I mean, there's a couple cool car chase scenes, but it's like nothing jumps out. It's like, it's just a vehicle to showcase The Rock and Jason Statham. That's cool, but maybe you could shave a half hour off of it. So I came away a little deflated. The trailers are a ton of fun, and I was hoping for a bit more, and it's not there.
The director did Deadpool 2.
He did do Deadpool 2. Okay.
Yeah, you said, because I knew I was about to catch you on that, because I know it was, I think Tim Miller did
Deadpool. He did Deadpool 1.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I looked, and like, it was like, he's known for, and they have him here on IMDb as, he's known as the ground church mutant in Deadpool 2. I was like, well, he directed Atomic Blonde. I know that one. maybe it was some of the directing. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm hoping it doesn't spell doom for Fast and Furious, but maybe it's also time for that series to end. They're coming up on their 9th film. They don't need to continue everything forever.
It is the weirdest series in the world to me. Like, right? I just don't.
So goofy.
Again, it feels like it hit its stride with the 5th one, which is like not normal. It's not the way things usually go.
No.
I'm not super into the series, but if you watch, say, part 5, and you go back and watch part 1, those are two completely different franchises, basically.
Oh, yeah. Like, part 1 is basically just a remake of Point Break,
and it's like,
but with cars.
It's like the new ones don't have anything to do with, like, street racing or anything.
Not at all. Like, the cars are still there. It's basically car porn. And they do some crazy set pieces, which I find fun. But it's mostly, like, these guys. I really just think it's a vehicle for Vin Diesel to get his friends together and make fun shit. And sometimes they put together fun stuff, like that heist in...
Yeah,
5.
I still remember that. Yep.
And other times they do dumb shit, but it's, I don't know, it's something. It's but I wouldn't rush out and see Hobbs and Shaw either. I mean, it's my 3rd of the night, but that's where I'm at with it. It's been a lot of meh.
All right. Well, hopefully our next film turns that around a little bit. This is one I've been really excited to talk with you about for, I feel like, a month now. We've been on this break for so long.
Yeah, we haven't recorded in a month, and it came out the 27th, so yeah. It was about 3 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the latest film from Quentin Tarantino. Takes place in 1969 L.A., and it follows Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt as these kind of friends. Leo is like this, you know, this kind of like fading movie star named Rick Dalton. And Brad Pitt is his like stunt guy named Cliff Booth. And just kind of follows them hanging around in LA during like the end of our innocence or whatever, as the Manson family kind of creeps around in the background and it builds towards this event that we all know is going to happen. You in the background, you have, you know, keeps cutting to Sharon Tate, played by Margot Robbie. And you get little glimpses of this, you know, this Manson cult, and you're like, well, you know what they're up to because you know the history. And the movie kind of plays on your expectations. We're going to get into, we're going to have a long spoiler discussion. I think we're going to have the formal review be a little short here. But the movie kind of plays on your expectations, and I think requires you to know just a bare minimum about who the Manson family was, like what they did.
Yes.
And I'm kind of also glad we did get to wait to talk about this so that some of the online chatter and the vitriol surrounding it has kind of died down a little bit. And also, we've had a little time to, like, get a little perspective. I've thought about this movie a lot since I've seen it, so hopefully that, like, gives me some more interesting things to say about it. But yeah, that's the setup, and I guess I'll just throw it to you real quick with, like, what you thought of it, and I'll give my thoughts to you, and then we'll get into spoilers after that.
I think that Tarantino has, he's filmed a loving tribute to a dead age of Hollywood. This is a love letter to filmmaking. It's a love letter to movies. It is a love letter to that age of movies. Particularly like the end of the cowboy and Western era. Yeah. He almost fetishizes the era to a degree.
Lots of fetishes in this.
But yes, we'll get to that. But I think like for that, like, and I think the film looks, it's a beautiful looking film. He has also perfectly cast it, at least with his three leads. And I actually think like there are other roles that are wonderful as well. But like Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt knock it out of the park.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt particularly, he is just, he is like the cool guy personified here. Like he nails it.
He is. And a lot of people have pointed to him as like, you know, he kind of steals the show and he's like the best part. But to me, it's like he's just doing the cool guy Brad. I'm not saying it's bad. I think it's really good. But he's doing the cool guy Brad Pitt thing where Leo is forced to go through the gamut of emotions here. And I found him really compelling.
Oh, yeah, because like, if you look at it, like, you know, what's his name? Cliff. He doesn't really have a huge arc. Like, he's just like, yeah, whatever. I live in my trailer and I do shit for Rick.
I have a theory on this when we get into spoilers as to why he's like that.
But Rick is like, he is a detailed character. He has an arc to him. He's not necessarily the most likable guy, but yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio does a great job. I think both of them are great here.
Yeah.
And I think if you're looking at acting, yes, like Leonardo DiCaprio definitely has that more nuanced performance. I think watching Brad Pitt is more fun because he's just a fun character.
Yeah.
And he brings a light brevity to the film, which does have a bit of a sad edge to it.
There's a sense of sadness over the whole thing. And, you know, you said it's like a love letter to that era. I just wanted to modify that a little bit because it's a love letter to the little things that get forgotten every year. Like, it's not about Midnight Cowboy or whatever. It's about, like, just random old TV shows and commercials. Yes. And shit that nobody remembers. And it's about, like, it really is, like, a big part of it. Like you said, it's fetishizing. It's, like, it's really about the little details of that. One detail I didn't even, like, it didn't even occur to me as I was watching, but was spelled out for me in an interview I watched or listened to afterwards, was the idea that, you notice how, like, as they cut between different characters and stuff in this, everyone's kind of listening to the same radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a deliberate thing. One, it was kind of like that back then, obviously, but it's him saying, like, we used to have a shared culture. Like, we all used to watch the same three networks. We all used to listen to the same radio station. And there was this kind of shared water cooler aspect of things. Whereas now, it's a very, I could be watching a whole bunch of shows that I think are absolutely great that you've never even heard of.
I mean, how many times we come on here and we have both watched a bunch of movies,
like, or whole TV shows that, yeah.
that neither, like, the other one has not experienced at all. So, yeah, we're a little more fractured because culture has expanded in such a way.
There's very few water cooler things now. Like, you know, the last really huge one was probably Game of Thrones.
Right.
Oh, Monday Night Football, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a whole lot. And even, like, football, it's like the people that don't care about football, like, they don't have to watch it anymore. It's not pervasive. It's
right. It's not like if you wanted to watch TV, that was what was on.
Yeah.
If I don't want to watch football, I have 998 other channels I can watch. Or I can jump on Netflix or Hulu or whatever and watch whatever the hell I want.
I don't think this is a perfect movie, and, you know, it's not my favorite Tarantino film. One thing this movie has inspired me to do is, just because I've been appreciating it, Tarantino, I've been, like, rewatching all of his films.
Okay.
And it's really hard to rank his films because they're all really spectacular. And
well, they're all very different, too.
Yeah.
Like, and
there.
I mean, that comparing this to Reservoir Dogs is, like,
almost pointless, yeah.
Right, because they're, it's not even that they're, you know, this is so much a character-driven drama, and not that there aren't characters in Reservoir Dogs, but it's such a more raw film. This is way more nuanced, and, like, he has learned a lot over, you know, the last 25, 30 years of filmmaking as well.
But there is a sense, and I think the movie is largely about this, that he's scared of losing his touch. I think that's what this movie's about. It's about a guy who's reaching that age where he's not as good as he used to be. I think this movie is largely, like, a meta commentary about, like, his own feeling about his abilities as a filmmaker. I hope he doesn't give in to that, like, that thought, because I think he's, like, our finest filmmaker, and it's just, he's a treasure. I don't want him to go away. I don't want him to stop at 10 films. I want him to keep going.
He needs a little girl to tell him that's the best directing she's ever seen.
Yeah.
I will say that, and I don't know about we didn't really discuss this prior. I don't know where you fall on this. You said it's not a perfect film. I was not necessarily drawn in by the subject matter. I don't have a nostalgia or a love for this era of Hollywood.
I also, I don't have an obsession with that era, and I don't have an obsession with the Manson story. I actually didn't look up any more about it. I know what I know about it, and, you know, I don't know a ton of details. I'm not, like, there's certain things, like Gacy. I know a lot about Gacy, right? Manson, I've always found it, I'm like, okay, yeah, I guess that was a thing that happened. A bunch of fucking idiots.
Right.
You know, did something stupid. So, I don't know if that works for or against it for me. I think the film has other problems for me. Like, I do think, you know, this is, like, all this stuff, you know, very indulgent, and it's long. And this one actually feels long to me a little bit. Some of his films, like, Pulp Fiction, I don't feel it at all. Pulp Fiction, I'm like, I'm
having I looked at the time. Like, it was like,
yeah,
like, because it didn't, and this is a problem, I think, with the film, is that it just goes on. Like, when it hits its final part, where it hits
so much fun at the end,
like,
for me.
Yeah, it just accelerates. Like, he's kind of cruising here, though. He's driving below the speed limit out on a Sunday drive for most of this film.
I think that's deliberate to set up the ending, because the ending comes like a splash of cold water on your face. And be like, oh, whoa, all right.
Yeah, and when we get into spoilers, I will, like, but yes, that the climax of it is that splash of cold water. But I do think, like, prior to that, there's like 2 hours of, like, he's just meandering along, and it's like, okay. I mean, I'm not against it, because Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt are chewing up scenery and delivering fantastic performances.
Yeah.
But I'm also like, what's the point?
I think that the second act, like, really sags. Like, I think, you know what my problem is? Is, like, all right, so I think some of the most wonderful scenes in the film and some of the most meaningful are in the middle where he's shooting that TV show where he's like, he has a guest star role on. Mm-hmm. And there's like this scene, there's a couple scenes between him and this young actress where it's kind of like Leo getting his groove back a little bit and kind of commenting, you know, like I said, there's like a meta commentary about Tarantino. I think that's some of the best stuff, but in order to get to it, we're often sitting through entire scenes of this movie within a movie stuff where it's like, I don't need the 5 minutes of acting before that to get to the, right. The scene that's dramatic for us. Like some of that movie within the movie stuff goes on way too long. There's a controversial scene that has gotten a lot of talk about Bruce Lee.
Was it the one with Cliff Booth?
Yeah, and it's
I love that scene, though.
I didn't care for it at all, but I didn't hate it for the reasons that some people are hating on it. Like,
I just think it's so stupid. Like,
it's like, fine. When I was watching it, I misread it as I thought the entire thing was him imagining what would happen if he went down to set.
Okay, I could see.
I was one of the people that read it wrong. Yeah, and if you read it wrong like that, if you read it as Cliff Booth daydreaming what would happen if he went to the set, it feels really excessive and stupid because it's something that didn't even happen. You know, unfortunately, I was wrong. It is something that happened in the past on the set of Green Hornet, I guess.
Right. Well, and I blame that on Tarantino, like the, because
it
of
is
the
a
way,
little clumsy, yeah.
The way he presents it, because it concludes with.
Oh, fair enough. And
yeah, that makes sense because he's thinking back on that, but it is not presented in that way. It's almost like, oh. Actually, like when it started, I'm like, what is going on here? Like, oh, he did get him that job and like he fought for him to get on there. And it's like, oh, they talked about the Green Hornet before. And now I see what's happening. So,
and it did. I hate to be one of the people that like fall on the side of it. When I was watching it the first time, and I've only seen it once so far, it did feel like disrespectful of Bruce Lee. And I know it's not meant that way. And I know that Tarantino's a huge Bruce Lee fan. So I'm like, what the fuck is this? And, you know, I've heard his explanation was, well, you know, this is a fictional story. So I could have my fictional characters able to beat up Bruce Lee. And, I guess it makes sense that he would want to establish that Brad Pitt is kind of like a force to be reckoned with.
Right.
We'll get into it. But I just didn't like it the first time, but again, part of my problem was I misread the scene. I was reading it wrong, so to me, it felt like it didn't need to be there.
Well, and that might be the other thing. It might not need to be there.
Yeah,
like we might not need to look, I enjoyed it because Brad Pitt is having a blast in that scene, but it's not, like as you said, like there's a lot in this film that is indulgent, and that just seems like, hey, I've put this 15-minute scene in that maybe doesn't need to be there. We could trim this a bit and tighten up the pacing.
So, and it'll be interesting for me to do a rewatch of this and see how I feel. Because, again, yeah, it does feel like a lot of stuff could have been cut, especially from the middle second, and just make it a little bit tighter. But it's like, you know, me going back and rewatching all these Tarantino movies, I'm so happy they have everything in it. I'm glad they're all long. I love all the bits. And just an interesting little side note, I've always come down, like, since when I saw Inglourious Basterds originally, I didn't like it. On this rewatch, I loved it. It was one of my favorite of his. So it's like, sometimes things don't land different. The right way. Well, I don't know. I went into it this time going, all right, this is the one you didn't like. And I'm watching it, and I'm like, this is absolutely compelling, and there's some really amazing stuff in this, especially the I've always liked the opening scene where Christoph Waltz comes to that cabin and they're hiding the Jewish people below the floorboards. I think it's always been one of the better like scenes in his filmography. But rewatching it, I was totally captivated the whole way. And actually, I feel this kind of spoiler to say, but I feel like a kinship between these two films, between Once Upon a Time and Inglourious Basterds. We'll get into that, but let's just say I appreciated what he was doing with history in Inglourious Basterds.
When we talk about kind of the spoilers here, I came away with two minds of how I reacted to this. My first was like, that's kind of gross. but then I thought more about it, and it is something to chew on, the ending to this film and how it happens and what he's done with history, with his kind of version of revisionist history this. So it's interesting, and it's at least worth talking about. I think you don't necessarily have to come away going, I liked it, but there's conversation to be had about it.
Yeah. You don't have to love it as much as me. I love the ending. I think that a lot of how much you like this film will depend on how much you love the ending, but I absolutely loved it. We're going to get into it very shortly here, but, I loved it personally, but fuck it, you know. Yeah, there's issues with the film. Again, it's not my favorite, but I think it pays off in a big way. It is a nice love letter to a different era. It's kind of about an era ending. It's about a time in your life ending, and I think it speaks directly to where Tarantino is in his own career.
Yeah.
I think for all those reasons, it's very special. Let's do your score, our scores, and then we have a bit more to talk about for sure. What are you giving Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I am going to give it a 4 and a recommend to go see. I think just from a filmmaking and acting kind of like a technical standpoint, like it's an amazing watch. There are things about it, though, which we've touched on some of them, that I think detracts a little bit from me coming down on, like, this is an amazing film.
See, I admit freely that there's flaws in it, but I also, I expect that when I rewatch it, I'm going to end up liking this movie more. And two, I'm going to pull a deep cut here, but I remember when we did our review of The Dark Knight Rises, and then your conclusion to that, you said, I just come out of this, I'm just grateful that we get these Christopher Nolan movies.
Yeah.
And you gave it a 5. That's how I feel about this. I'm like, I'm just grateful that we have Tarantino. It's so much more interesting than 95% of the stuff that's out there.
Like, regardless of your take on Tarantino, personally, and I know that that's something that
people that don't like him,
which fine, like that's fine, but he is creating art that is worthy to be talked about. And it, you know, we just reviewed 3 movies prior to this, and I would say that none of them really deserve to be talked about.
And
I've forgotten them already.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm outside of those 3 films, how much of the stuff that we get now is Marvel movies or remakes? So much of it. And to have someone out there with an original voice making original films, getting to do whatever the fuck he wants, and it's still a big event that people care about. And this thing is one of the top grossing films of the year. You know, it's actually one of only 2 movies this year that was an original film that broke 100 million. I forgot what the other one was now. But I'm just thankful and I'm grateful for all of this. I'm giving him a 5. This is going to end up on my end of the year list. But let's get into, I guess the big thing to discuss is the ending. I mean, there's other things too that are spoilery, I guess, throughout that we could touch on, but kind of blanking on it. The thing I've wanted to talk about forever is the ending. So, you know, if you've seen this, you know, or you may have read, if you haven't seen it, that it changes what happens in real life.
It prevents the Manson murders.
Yeah. So instead of them going and, you know, Sharon Tate's in this and you can see like the house right next door, basically they end up at the wrong house and they pick the wrong people to fuck with, which is our heroes, Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton. And they just get fucking annihilated by them in some very gruesome and gory fashion.
And you're laughing. And
oh god,
it is gruesome. It is gory. But I And we've talked about this previously, where it's like people laugh in a film where it's not meant to be laughed. Mm-hmm. And I just like when he slams her head.
I started clapping. I started clapping at that.
I just started laughing. I'm like, this is the most absurd shit I have seen this year, and it's great.
I saw this opening, so cathartic. I saw this opening weekend at like a 7 o'clock, Saturday night showing. Right, biggest reaction from a movie audience this year. I mean, the crowd went fucking apeshit when this thing exploded because you so masterfully lulled you. Very slow rhythm, and
almost to sleep.
And then all of a sudden, this movie explodes into probably one of his most violent scenes ever in any of his movies. Like, it's like horror level gore.
Oh yeah, her skull just caves in.
Yeah, you can see her head. Her skull just like caving in against this fucking like mantle or whatever.
And then like with the even before that, when he throws the fucking can of dog food at
her. It's such a great throw. It's just like bam. Now,
like it just and her you just see her face cave in, like to like her nose breaks and like blood gushes everywhere. It's fucking nuts.
And me as a mailman, I got the fear of the dog. Actually, I'm not afraid of dogs at all. When a dog approaches me, I don't freak out. But if it's a pit bull, I do get a little like, oh shit. This pit bull is vicious. They do a great setup and payoff with that, where it's like kind of a Chekhov gun through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another Chekhov gun too that I really loved that plays throughout this entire ending, and that is very early in the film. Cliff Booth is giving an acid dipped cigarette.
Yes.
And right before these Manson folks show up, he decides they first of all go out and get shit faced before this. And so, like, our two main characters are shit faced drunk at the end of this movie. And of course, that's the time when you always think it's a good time to, oh, now I'll drop some acid.
Right.
And he does, and he's tripping balls through this entire, like, encounter. It made it even funnier, and just like, and Brad Pitt really does a good job of playing like he's on acid.
His whole experience with it is like great, but I think the other side of it is that like Rick is so drunk
that he's oblivious to the whole thing. Yeah,
all of this shit is going on, like all this noise. His wife is screaming, the dog is barking and growling, these people are yelling, and he is passed out in a pool float. Just floating around his pool until one of them falls into it.
Yeah, and then speaking of Chekhov guns, he fucking has the flamethrower that got set up earlier. And the crowd roared when he fucking unleashed that on her. Like, it's just so great. Also, so great in this whole last sequence is before any of this happens, they like kind of pull in his driveway. And Rick Dalton's fucking shit face making fucking margaritas in the blender. Mm-hmm. And he goes out to yell at them, and he's holding the fucking blender full of margarita in his hand and screaming. Like, yeah. That's so fucking funny. I was dying at that, dude. Like, it was so good. The whole, like, this whole bit, like, again, like I said, the hugest audience reaction of the year for me. Like, nothing even came close. Like, everyone was fucking mad. Like, I know when he started bashing her head against the fireplace, I started clapping, and, like, some other people started clapping, too. People are just laughing, hooting, and hollering. It's a lot of fun, but there's a meaning to all of this too, I think. And I think, a lot of this movie is about the power of film, and I think what Tarantino is saying is like, the world may be screwed up and bad things happen that we can't control, but guess what? Here, we get to control it. Yeah. And here, Sharon Tate lives and has a great career.
Yeah, so And that's how I've come around on it now.
Yeah.
Leaving it, I felt a little gross. Like,
you're just like, what the fuck?
I loved like that whole sequence, which is absurd to say, cause it's just this brutally violent sequence of a film. But I also come away going, I don't know. I just felt a little gross that like, oh, well, he has indulged himself and I've changed history. And like, there we go. It's like, how dare you? But then thinking about it, like, and actually reading some stuff after the fact,
yeah. It's a love letter to her. He liked her so much. He wished that she got to go on. You know.
Well, and it's a. I mean, this film is. I mean, there's definitely the personal side of, you know, just Sharon Tate, but there's also this fact that incident killed something in America and in filmmaking, and he wants to kind of rewind that and say, no, like, we're going to allow this to continue. No, whether you think that error, I mean, there are definitely some problematic shit that was still going on in that era that
for sure
would have needed to change.
But some of that's in this, you know.
Yeah. But there's just like being able to go, yes, like, you know, as a filmmaker, I can change history. I can create the stories I want to tell, and the people that we love to see, they can continue to live on screen. So yeah, my first reaction was like, it's kind of gross. I liked the film, but
like, also it was like disrespectful to the legacy, yeah, like what happened. But yeah,
because they were real people that really died.
Yeah, and now you're just like whitewashing that. But I never felt that way. Like I got his message right away. Like when I was watching it, I was just like, oh, I get it. You're taking it back. You know, like, this is like how you wanted it to be. And I appreciated it for that.
It's funny that, like, you brought up Inglourious Basterds, because he does the same thing there, right?
But it's different, because I was going to mention this. He changes history in Inglourious Basterds. That's why I think there's a little kinship between these two. But there, it's not so different from real life. Like, Hitler did lose, you know what I mean? And he did end up dying. So.
And also, I mean, this is terrible to say, because, you know, everything that has happened, you know, everything that happened in World War II was atrocious, and very much like the Nazis are terrible people, but we have made them into cartoon villains in a sense. Yeah. And that's kind of what I felt there. So I didn't have that like weird reaction, like, oh, he's changing it. Like, and as you said, like, Hitler ultimately lost. We, you know, the Allies beat him.
It's interesting though. I think he turns the Manson family into cartoon villains here. Like,
he does.
He has such disdain for hippies in this. It's so fucking clear. And kind of, I think it's, some of it is a little bit of a commentary on like the slacktivist culture that's going on right now, where people think that posting shit on Twitter is the same as actually doing something.
Right.
I think he has a little bit of a, you know, he's not on Twitter, I think, but I think he just a little bit of that, like a little bit of him twisting life, like, you guys are all so full of shit, just like these fucking people were. But yeah, I don't know. It worked for me. One other thing I wanted to touch on that I forgot, and I don't know how much spoilery it is, but I just forgot to bring about it, is the Spahn Ranch sequence. That was wonderful, like tense, like suspenseful filmmaking in that section. It was almost up there with some of the Inglourious Basterds scenes,
and it's almost horror level of of filmmaking. Like,
you think something bad's about to go down,
right? Well, I'm thinking like, this is, you know, because, you know, Brad Pitt he's the supporting role here, right? Like, they can off him at any time. We've seen supporting roles that are only for, you know, a couple minutes on screen. So I'm thinking like, this is where he bites it, like, and. Yeah. And the way they film it, the way they frame it, I would love to see Tarantino do a horror film, because he has a sense of being able to build tension in that way. And that whole Spahn Ranch sequence is phenomenal.
By the way, in that Spahn Ranch sequence, this is just like trivia shit. Bruce Dern plays like the old dude in the bed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally supposed to be Burt Reynolds, but he died. And they actually, like, you know, he had done some work, but he died.
He read for it.
Yeah.
I believe he might have even done like dress rehearsal for at some point.
Which would have been nice to see Burt Reynolds get another, like, you know, Boogie Nights was like this nice comeback for him or whatever. It would have been nice to see him in one like last great movie or whatever. Yeah, I guess that kind of wraps. I mean, we could probably end up going about another hour on
yeah
on Once Upon a Time, but I enjoyed it. I'm interested to see it again to see, you know, how some of the things I didn't like, whether like they get smoothed out or I come to appreciate its pacing more leading up to that fantastic ending. So much fun to talk about it finally. I guess a couple more real quick. Euphoria wrapped up. I've said a little bit about the show. I thought that it was really fantastic. And definitely probably the best show of the year, which is, it's been a year of really great shows. I will say that I think that the finale didn't quite live up to the quality of some of the episodes leading up to it. So that was kind of a letdown, but even still, it was a 5-star show for me. So do check it out, Chris, if you get a chance. Okay. Everybody, anybody listening, if you have not watched it, Euphoria is like must see. It's like, it feels like the filmmaking in it feels like late 90s Paul Thomas Anderson. It feels like Boogie Nights. It feels like Magnolia, like this really kinetic. And just, you know, really well-written characters. Even like the people who are like really small, minor side characters feel, it feels like the show understands them as real people. Like it knows them down to the bone. Again, watch Euphoria. It's really, really good. The other thing that just wrapped up was Handmaid's Tale season 3.
Mm-hmm.
That show I was getting a little frustrated with because it's like it sets up this dystopia and it's been 3 seasons of just how awful it is. And I'm like, when is something going to happen? When are some of the bad people on here going to get their comeuppance? And then this season, especially, I'm starting to feel it because we're in season 3 now. I'm like, when is anything going to happen to shift the dynamic in this world? It's just been 3 seasons of how awful women are treated and how horrible it is, and them getting raped after episode after episode. I'm like, when does the dynamic shift here? Well, luckily, in the last 3 episodes of season 3, shit finally happened, so it redeemed itself, in my opinion. So that, you know, that's available on Hulu now. I would probably give season 3 of it 4 stars. It's a really compelling show, and you know, you've heard me talk about the show before. It's like it's an eerie, like almost warning, and it feels like we're slipping into the reality of the show.
Yeah, I don't know if it's I don't know if anybody's catching the warning.
Sadly. Yeah. But it is like impossible to miss like some of the connections. So that's that. And a couple programming notes going forward as we come back from this hiatus. We should be back week to week now, from now through the end of the year, I believe.
Yep.
Starting next week, we are going to be doing a series rewatch of the Rambo films. The idea here for me being, well, August is kind of a dead zone. I like some kind of action movies in the summer. Also, there's that new Rambo film coming out that does not look very good. It looks to me like a direct-to-video fucking movie.
Yeah.
But I just figured, hey, let's watch some dumb Rambo movies. Let's reassess the series, see where it is, how we feel about it now. I did not expect to be going into this week with like 2 movies I'm also going to go see in the theater, so we're going to have a packed episode next week. And going forward for the rest of the year, for Halloween, we're doing this year, you know, we've already done Friday the 13th, we've done Halloween, it's time now to finally dig into, I think, the lesser of all 3 of these, the Nightmare on Elm Street series. Sorry to movie guru.
I think Halloween is the high point of any of those films, but I think Nightmare might have the second best film out of that series. But yes, it does not hold as much water as either of those.
They're on Shudder right now, and if you go on to Shudder now, they've really redesigned the app, and it's really awesome. And
it's amazing looking, yeah.
And when you turn on Shudder, it's like Shudder TV is just playing, and I really love that because I love just turning it on and going, okay, I'll watch whatever you're playing. They've been playing a lot of the Nightmare on Elm Street, so I've been seeing clips of the movies. I'm just like, good God, the series, man. It really fucking takes a shit at some point. So we're going to do the Nightmare on Elm Street series. I promise I'll give them a fair assessment as I watch them unfold, take notes and all that. And then for the end of the year, Chris, we typically do a best of episode where we do two episodes. We do our awards, like specific awards, like best actor, etc. And then we do our time of the year. And we're going to do both of those episodes this year. But this year as well, I'm going to add two more episodes for the month of December. And those will be our top 10 horror films of the decade, followed by our top 10 general films of the decade.
Okay.
So, a lot of big, I mean, that's some huge episodes coming up. I do have some other special stuff in the works, but I don't want to speak on it in case it falls through. But yeah, we got a lot of interesting stuff coming. Yeah. So, thanks for sticking around and waiting for us through the hiatus. We have a lot of fun planned. We'll be back next week with, I'm going to have that weird Bruce Springsteen movie, The Blinded by the Light. I'm going to have Good Boys. Chris, you're going to see, what's the third movie?
Whatever that shark movie is.
Oh, 47 Meters Down 2, yeah.
Yeah, and I might also see Good Boys. So.
And we're going to have First Blood and Rambo First Blood Part 2. So it's going to be a packed episode next week. Please come back.
Movie dudes! Do-do-do-do-do!